Think of the last time you put some ice in a beverage. Probably pretty recently, given our summer heat. For me, this morning in my coffee, last night in a mocktail. Did you stop to think about how convenient it is that you have ice on demand? It's probably always been that easy to cool off a drink, right? Well, not so fast. There's a centuries-old story about how we came to use frozen water as a commodity in the U.S. and around the world. It even involves some good old-fashioned hardball business practices right here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you ever had to go without ice or without refrigeration, how did that affect you and your food and beverage choices? How do you use ice in your day-to-day life? Big fan of skating rinks, say? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Amy Brady is executive director of Orion Magazine, a contributing editor for Scientific American and co-editor of The World as We Knew It, Dispatches from a Changing Climate. Her new book is called Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
What motivated you to stop taking ice for granted and tackle it in this book?
A few years ago, there was a heat wave that gripped the planet, and I was visiting family back in my home state of Kansas. The heat wave knocked out the power into their house, and so we piled into their car and went to a nearby gas station that was operating on a generator. Inside, there was air conditioning, there was a soda machine, and I filled a cup with ice to try to cool down. And as I was watching that ice fall into my cup, it just occurred to me that I hadn't thought twice about whether ice would be available. I just knew if I went to that gas station, I'd find it. Or if I went the other direction to the nearby grocery store, I could have bought a bag of ice. And I wondered, why is that the case? Why is ice available everywhere? Because it really isn't in other places around the world. Well, when I got home and the electricity came back on, I tried to do some research to find an answer to that question, and I couldn't find a satisfying answer. So I decided to look more in depth, and ultimately a fascinating history of how ice on demand came to be started to reveal itself. And that was the premise for this book.
Now, back in the day, you could have ice if you were rich and lived in a place that had frozen ponds or rivers nearby. You dig into the story of the first ice entrepreneur in the United States who ends up shipping ice to the Caribbean. Can you share a little bit of his story and how he made this an actual business?
Yeah, the first person to make ice into a business, he was the person who launched the American ice trade. His name was Frederick Tudor. He was a wealthy Bostonian. Some might have called him a madman. People did call him a madman in his day. And as a late teen and then a man in his early 20s, he landed on this idea to carve large blocks of ice out of his family's lake on their estate in Massachusetts and ship it to people who lived in warm climates around the world. And he just knew that once people got a taste of cold, they would never look back, and he would make millions of dollars. And it took years and years of trial and error, but that eventually was the case.
And it wasn't a gimme. The thing he had to do, the marketing technique he stumbled on, was to actually give ice free to bartenders, right, and say, hey, you can make cold rum drinks instead of room temperature rum drinks. How did that catch on?
That's exactly right. So one of the first places that he tried to sell ice to were people living in Cuba. And what he knew after years of failure there, he just couldn't get people to buy his ice, was that nobody in Havana trusted him, but they all trusted their local baristas. Cafe culture was dominant in Cuba. So he went to the local cafes and he said to the owners, look, I'm going to give you some ice for free. And that way you can use it to make these most delicious drinks. And then you can sell it to your customers at the same price as you would sell lukewarm drinks. And let's just see which one they like the best. Well, just as in today, back then, you really can't argue with a cold drink on the rocks. And people clamored for it. And he ended up making a killing.
Talking to Amy Brady about her new book, Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts on ice, its accessibility, its history. Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Chris is with us in Adams. Chris, hi.
Hi. I was living in Lowell, And the bartender said that there was a tunnel underneath this bar. And we thought about what it could possibly be. Then I went and did a little bit of investigation. It was a tunnel from the river up through the bar to the brewery at the top of the hill. And they would take horses and cut big blocks of ice out of the river and take them up through the tunnel all the way from the brewery down to the river. And they put hay on top of them, and then they put the beer in there. And it lasted all summer.
Chris, thank you so much for sharing that story. Now, Amy, that wasn't the only place that was happening in Wisconsin. You write of an ice war in Milwaukee where they were supplying ice to brewers, making cold German lagers there. What ended up happening?
This is one of my favorite stories that came out of my research. So in the early 20th century, around 1900, 1901, there was a company harvesting ice out of the Milwaukee River that went by, ironically, as the Wisconsin Lakes Ice and Cartage Company. And Wisconsin Lakes was the only ice company in the region for years and years and years. But then that changed when another company came in called the Pike and North Lake Company that started harvesting ice out of Lake Michigan. Well, this was at the peak of the Industrial Revolution when rivers were really, really dirty. And so the Pike Company launched this smear campaign against Wisconsin Lakes that was harvesting out of the Milwaukee River, saying that their ice was really dirty. Well, Wisconsin Lakes didn't take kindly to that. So they looked at Pike Company's infrastructure to see, is there any way that we can get back at them? And sure enough, what they realized was that the Pike Company had bought land to build their ice houses close to the railroads, the same type of railroads that was probably delivering ice to that bar that your caller just talked about. But what they had failed to do was to buy the land between the ice houses and the railroads. So Wisconsin Lakes ended up buying that intermediate land area and then waited until Pike Company had harvested a bunch of ice and was ready to bring it to the railroads for delivery. And when they did that, Wisconsin Lake slapped them with a trespassing order, and all of their ice went to waste. Well, Pike Company decided this was war. And so what they did in retaliation was really one of the best acts of revenge I think I've ever read. What they did is that they waited until that Wisconsin Lakes was harvesting for their next big delivery. Now at the time, river tourism was pretty popular. And so what Pike Company did is that they bought a steamship and sold tickets to tourists. But what separated their steamship from all the other touristy steamships is that they outfitted theirs with an icebreaker. And so right when Wisconsin Lakes was getting ready to harvest their ice, they filled the ship, they hired a band to play a jazzy tune, and as the band played, they brought their steamship right through the ice that Wisconsin Lakes was harvesting, sending the ice harvesters running and breaking that valuable ice into millions of splinters. It was really like Titanic in reverse.
Pretty cold-hearted. Now, Amy, before we enter the industrial ice era, I want to check out a historical character I didn't know existed. Now, we get to a point where people have ice boxes in their house. They get ice deliveries, right into their door. And there's this iconic figure of the sexy Iceman. Tell us about him.
So one of the most fascinating things I uncovered in my research was that by the time we get to the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, when ice delivery to people's homes was reaching its peak, we also find all of these popular songs with lyrics about housewives falling in love with the Iceman. I also found these vintage Valentine's Day cards with puns about the sexy Iceman. And I was wondering, why is this? Why was this nation fascinated with Icemen? Because they weren't the only delivery men of the era. There were milkmen, there were mailmen. But what I realized is that of all the delivery people of the era, the Iceman was the only one to come inside the house to bring their product to the kitchen. And they would often come into the house when the husband was away at work. And this was a time when there was a lot of anxiety around women being alone with men who weren't their husbands. And so this created a nationwide fascination and an anxiety around the Iceman. One of my favorite cultural finds was this song that was written in the 1930s that was later popularized by Ray Charles that went something like, I'm moving to the outskirts of town and I'm buying my woman a Frigidaire so we can get rid of that Iceman.
We're talking to Amy Brady, executive director of Orion Magazine. Her new book is called Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about ice, how we used to get it, what led to the era of freezers in every home? Do you rely on ice for entertainment? Maybe that skating rink, curling, for example? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Orion Magazine executive editor Amy Brady. We're talking about her new book. It's called Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We're big, it turns out, on ice here in the United States. I know I am. Have you traveled to some place where ice wasn't really a thing? What was that like for you? Or are you from outside of the United States? Are you wondering, what's our deal with all the ice? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Amy, the creation of artificial ice, not collected from nature, it changed our beverages, our food, a lot of other things. And another, you spent a chapter or two on sports, and this really shook things up, especially in the ways that women could be out doing sports in public. Can you talk about, artificial ice surfaces and how they change things?
Absolutely. So ice skating was really popular in the early 19th century, even before we had indoor skating rinks. And one of the reasons why they were so popular was because young couples could enjoy ice skating outdoors together, spending time together, without being under the watchful eye of a guardian. ice skating really was seen as the domain of young people, lest an older person fall and hurt themselves, or so went the thinking of the day. And so because it was so popular among young couples, women were encouraged to take part in the activity. And at the time, there were some, but not a lot of physical sports-like activities that women were encouraged to participate in. And so because women were ice skating, they had to consider how their garments affected their ability to stay upright on the slippery ice. And this was an era when women's skirts were very long. And so it was easy to trip on them. So they started hiking up their skirts and ultimately started buying clothing that was just a little bit shorter so that they wouldn't trip over their garments. And so in this way, ice skating led to changing social mores about women showing off their ankles and wearing shorter hemlines.
And then we had sports like curling and hockey that existed in some forms on frozen ponds before that, but the ability to create this surface, and not just when it was cold, how did it change those games?
Well, prior to indoor ice skating, sports like ice hockey and curling, though curling barely existed in the United States before indoor ice rinks. It was really just ice hockey and ice skating. Prior to the invention of indoor skating rinks, these were activities that were only experienced in northern climates where ice formed naturally. But once we had the ability to create indoor skating rinks, we could bring that popular pastime of ice skating that once only took place on, say, the Wisconsin, the Milwaukee River or the Hudson, could suddenly take place in Florida or Arizona. And that radically popularized sports. Now there are, ice skating rinks in almost every state in the union. And there aren't a lot of sports where you can say that it's, so popular that there are spaces dedicated to it in every single state.
Your book is bookended with a change in climate. Ice becomes less available at the end of the little ice age. Rivers and lakes aren't freezing as much. And now there's concern. In an irony, you write, we're using a lot of energy to make ice to help us deal with the heat, but that in turn is contributing to climate change. Can you talk about some of those concerns?
Yeah, well, the popularization of ice and the need for cold, the American need for cold, led to the rise of electric refrigeration. And today, there are approximately 110 million electric refrigerators working in the United States alone. And a majority of those refrigerators have automated ice makers, which means that the refrigerator, which is already takes a significant energy draw, draws even more energy because those automated ice makers have motors that never turn off. That's why you can have ice at any time of day or night. Well, all of that energy use is starting to take a toll on the planet. The cooling industry contributes approximately 10% of all carbon emissions, which is means it's not the most significant, contributor of global warming, but it's not insignificant. And as somebody who absolutely loves ice, I'm never giving up my ice. I love it. But also as somebody who believes in living as gently on the earth as I can, I was curious to learn, are there experts thinking about this problem? And are there any solutions that, you know, might be possible in my lifetime? And I was so excited to learn that there are people who are experimenting with technologies such as certain types of magnets, the material called plastic crystals, which actually have nothing to do with plastic. It's a word that describes their structure, the molecular structure. They're learning that these materials can actually mimic the type of compression technology that more conventional refrigerators use that draw considerably less energy. And they also don't rely on the same type of traditional refrigerants that contribute to global warming that that conventional refrigerants do. So I'm very excited about this. If we can scale up that technology, that could be a game changer for the cooling industry. And gosh, if there's anything I've learned in writing this book, it's that Americans can adapt new types of technology and make widespread transformations in a relatively short amount of time.
Talking to Amy Brady about her new book called Ice. Let's bring on another caller. Laura is with us in Twin Lakes. Laura, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I love the subject. And about in 2019, I took a trip to Alaska. And on one of the excursions, we were served glacial ice in our drinks. And it was just so totally awesome. It was like a blue-white. And it was a great experience, yeah.
Could you tell the difference in the drink, Laura?
You know, it was just, yeah, I think it was partly just in your head. You know, you just realized it was so cold and delicious. I don't know.
Laura, thanks a lot for that call. Amy, that actually that brings me around to something you spent some time in the book, the aesthetics of ice in our drinks. And there are people who argue, I think, about the best shape of ice, the best source of ice to have in our cocktails. What do we know?
Well, the shape, the size, the texture of the ice that you put in your drink can radically change the flavor. Different sizes of ice dilute at different speeds. Some ice is actually just colder than other types of ice. And then there's also the way that ice looks. Ice straight out of a conventional ice machine is a little bit cloudy in the center. And what some bartenders are thinking about is whether a clear ice can make a difference. And what their clientele is telling them is that, yeah, it does make a difference. The drink tastes better. And to my mind, it also just looks better. And so when you go to an upscale cocktail bar in this day and age, don't be surprised if the ice in your cocktail looks extra fancy. And also don't be surprised if that cocktail costs a little more than you're used to, because super clear ice is pretty expensive.
Thanks for that call, Laura. And that takes me back to something early in your book, Amy. Now, the early blocks of ice you mentioned, towed by horses. Now, I've been in marching band back in high school, and I marched in parades behind horses. I know what comes out of the back of horses. This was an issue for our ice quality back in the day, right?
Oh boy, was it ever. So, ice harvesters often employed horses to help cut the ice and then to haul it out of the lakes and rivers and into the back of wagons so that it could be delivered to people's homes. And as you say, horses being the mammals that they are, often let loose their bowels on the ice, the very ice that would soon touch the mouths of thirsty Americans everywhere. And so all ice harvesting crews employed a man who would pull what was called a shine sleigh. And the job of the shine sleigh was to scrape the horse's waist off the ice so that it could be delivered. And it got its name from the oily shine that it would leave behind.
Yum. That's a great place to leave it. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Amy Brady, Executive Director of Orion Magazine. We talked to her today about her new book. It's called Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. You can keep sharing your thoughts on ice. Do you have a favorite ice to put in a particular beverage? Let us know about it. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org.